The following programming is sponsored by Dr. Joseph Fallon Jr. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group.
It's time once again to get inside the world of medicine as prominent endocrinologist Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr. brings you Inside Medicine. Stay tuned for interviews with eminent medical specialists and receive vital information about your health. Now, here is Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr. with another edition of Inside Medicine.
Good morning, Philadelphia and Jersey. Welcome to Inside Medicine, a weekly program, 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. on WWDB AM. I do want to point out that we have about 125 podcasts up. If you want to listen to older shows, www.wwdbam.com. Hit Inside Medicine on the podcast, and then you can pick up 125 previous shows. I just want to start out with a little quote. Too often we accept the superficial over the substantive and settle for a quick, easy solution rather than doing the hard work to find a superior answer. That was by Leroy Ims. I want to point out that things are getting better all the time. And if you're a woman, we've had a recent publication out of the New England Journal of Medicine on heart transplantation. And they used a thyroid medication to see if they could advance more qualified hearts to needing patients. But just to start off, there is a significant new drug on the market. Hopefully it will pan out to be very well. VeoSah. So VeoSah is for gals who have hot flashes. This drug is not an estrogen because we all know that estrogens do a great job at blocking hot flashes. The only problem is that estrogens can have side effects, and a lot of people aren't willing to take those side effects, and they have to suffer a bit. This is a new drug on the market. I have not seen any patient with it yet, but hopefully it will reduce those hot flashes, which will make people live a lot better and have a better life, and that may just decrease their need for any kind of estrogen supplement. The drug overall has some side effects, such as stomach ache, diarrhea, back pain, hot flashes that don't get better, so maybe you're not the case. But again, new drug on the market, hopefully it'll help, because there's so many gals who have significant hot flashes and are willing to take estrogens, even if it is a risk to their overall longevity. VeoZah, V-E-O-Z-A-H. I do want to give another quote. This is from Leroy Ims. Too often we accept the superficial over the substantive and settle for a quick, easy solution rather than doing the hard work to find a superior answer. I like that, and it reminds me of people at the casino. Second quote. This is from Adam Grant. He's a Wharton School professor and author, local guy. Good leaders build products. Great leaders build cultures. Good leaders deliver results. Great leaders develop people. Good leaders have vision. Great leaders have values. Good leaders are role models at work. Great leaders are role models in life. Gotta like that. Congratulations to the Wharton professor. What about local issues? Are flu cases rising? And RSV may be peaking. Flu is picking up steam, while RSV lung infections that can hit children and older people hard may be peaking, U.S. health officials said. COVID-19, though, continues to cause the most hospitalizations and deaths among respiratory illnesses, about 15,000 hospitalizations and about 1,000 deaths every week. Yikes. This was reported by Mandy Cohen, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The agency is also looking into reports of pneumonia outbreaks in children in two states, but Cohen said there is no evidence that they are due to anything unusual. In the last month, RSV, respiratory syncytial virus, infections rose sharply in some parts of the country, nearly filling hospital emergency departments in Georgia, Texas, and some other states. But quote, we think we're near the peak of RSV season, or will be in the next week or so. Good things there. Another item that came up in Philadelphia. interesting politics here, as Philly always has. Philadelphia City Council passed legislation to ban ski masks in some public spaces, a measure supporters say will increase public safety amid high volume crime, but opponents argue will unfairly target people without proof of any wrongdoing. Always two sides of the coin. The legislation passed on Thursday with a 13-2 vote and now goes to Democratic Mayor Jim Kenney. A spokesperson said he would review the legislation and, quote, looks forward to our ongoing work with City Council in the urgent matter of ensuring public safety, end quotes. The measure would ban ski masks or balaclavas in public spaces like schools, recreation centers, parks, city-owned buildings, and on public transportation. The fine, $250, would be imposed against anyone who violates the law and its exceptions for religious garb and protest. So how about if we kind of get a little bit here to a biotech phenomena? I'm very happy to say this, that there is an article in Investors Business Daily today, biotech's revolutionary drug gets nod and share surge. So CRISPR Therapeutics just executed on a moonshot goal as it recently won UK approval for the first gene editing treatment ever. The move sent CRISPR stock skyward, and now the company and partner Vertex Pharmaceuticals are looking to do it again. This drug is one that basically can reverse the pain the kids get when they have when their blood vessels tend to clot over and they just kind of fall apart. So in November, the UK's Medicines and Healthcare Products Regulatory Agency approved CRISPR's drug for patients aged 12 and older with blood diseases known as sickle cell disease or beta thalassemia. The Food and Drug Administration plans to make its decision on the drug for treating sickle cell disease on December 8th and as a beta thalassemia medication on March 30th. I have to tell you this, when I was did a rotation in my medical school in Peds, that was the one thing I hated, was taking care of those poor kids who had sickle cell disease. The pain was incredible. And the problem was that they'd get out of the hospital and then come back in a week or two in pain again. So it was a incredibly bad life that I could see. And that is one of the reasons that I didn't want to be a pediatrician, because I just couldn't stand the pain that those sickle cell kids suffer recurrently. Anyway, Chief Executive Sam Kulkarni says that the gene editing technology known as CRISPR, C-R-I-S-P-R, from which the company derived its name, has moved at lightning speed. Just 3 years ago, the researchers won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry, receiving credit for discovering the CRISPR technology in 2011. Now the technology has won its first approval. That's in Europe, coming around the corner for the U.S. I hope it comes on board, because those kids certainly need help. The platform uses a molecular, quote, scissors to make cuts in the DNA specific places. From there, it can add, remove, or change genetic code. Kulkarni, one of the top authors there, compares it to, quote, molecular surgery. So taking your gene, cutting it up, splicing it up, putting it back together again in a different way, apparently can be incredibly saving for these kids. It's a procedure that we're offering to them that would potentially help them be cured for life. That means the actual genetic editing is applied to the patient's cells outside of the body via the drug rather than inside the patient. The overall bottom line is that this is a tremendous breakthrough, and we anticipate that CRISPR technology will move forward. I do note that the company is testing two in vivo gene editing approaches for atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease. Can you believe that we're now going to have gene splitting for coronary artery disease? The world is moving ahead. There is additionally a plaque buildup in arterial walls that hopefully they're going to do this gene editing, which will decrease plaque buildup, because we all know that heart disease is the number one killer in the U.S., almost overtaken by COVID about 2 years ago. But heart disease that would be cured would be phenomenal. You got to get to keep that plaque out. Overall, they even give us a temp and say that they're going to do gene editing for diabetes. That'll be absolutely fantastic. So again, good news on the research front, and congratulations to CRISPR. Want to give you guys a little bit of a case study. So a 67-year-old man was referred to a diabetologist for treatment of uncontrolled diabetes. The patient was on five medications, including insulin, semaglutide, the new stuff, the 1 milligram they can take once a week, canaflozin, another high powerful drug, metformin, been around forever but works well, and pioglitazone 30. The patient was on, that was for diabetes, hypertension was losartan, hypothyroidism was levothyroxine, angina medication, ranzolidine, cardiomyopathy, carbidiol, and hypercholesterolemia, atorvastatin. The patient's laboratory showed an A1C terrible at 10.9. Got to get this guy tuned up. He did a dexamethasone test overnight, which is to try and see if cortisol is out of balance. The result was 1.9, and it should have been less than 1.8, making people think a hypercortisol state. AM dexamethasone test failed. ACTH was a 10 and DHEA a 6. The patient basically was diagnosed to have uncontrolled diabetes, truncal obesity around the belly, acanthosis nigricans, that's where you get a darkening around your neck, insomnia, depression, fatigue, what a life, and cardiovascular complications. The patient was treated with Korlym, K-O-R-L-Y-M, and the patient had a significant improvement in well-being. His weight dropped from 199 to 180. The patient's A1C dropped from 10.9 to a normal 5.7. Weight loss was 19 pounds. Depression improved. The medication did phenomenal. So again, we have newer drugs coming. Korlym, K-O-R-L-Y-M, did a phenomenal job with this individual with diabetes, significant insulin resistance, significant depression, and significant poor diabetic control. Things improved, which was fantastic. Now, do want to talk about weight loss stocks. Can you believe that? Talking about weight loss stocks. So it turns out that if you take a look at the stock market, the GLP-1 stocks have really improved tremendously. So you have companies like Eli Lilly, Novo Nordisk, which have done incredibly well. We have people demanding, hoping to get their medications, which have resulted in significant weight loss, significant reduction in sugar, significant reduction in heart attack, significant reduction in stroke, and also it makes you look better, I would assume, why people want it so bad. The problem is that the drug companies just can't keep up with it. The results are phenomenal. People can say, why don't you use the older drugs? Because when you have a drug that can stop stroke and stop MI, it's kind of hard not to want that medication. Want to move a little bit forward to RSV infection, back in that. So respiratory syncytial virus causes respiratory infections with symptoms such as cough, runny nose, sore throat, and headache. In older adults, respiratory syncytial virus can cause more severe disease, including pneumonia, worsening symptoms of asthma, and chronic obstructive COPD. The bottom line is these generally are mild cold symptoms of cough, runny nose, sore throat, headache, and last less than 5 days. However, some of the older adults can cause severe disease such as pneumonia and aggravate their asthma or chronic obstructive lung disease. So RSV infections and the incidence of severe infections begin in the fall and peak in the winter. We are just about ready to have that time over, thank God. Each year, RSV causes 60,000 to 160,000 hospitalizations. Certainly would be nice to avoid that, keep the money in the hospital pocket so they can be good for those who don't have money. And up to 10,000 adults are older than 60 have that kind of problem. So the risk factor for RSV, and again, we're just about over the season, is age, lung disease such as COPD and asthma, heart disease such heart failure, coronary artery disease, diabetes comes up again, kidney disease, liver disease, blood disease. So there's a lot of indications that people will be prone to RSV. There is a vaccine out for that. My impression is that the high hit time is just about over. I think it's got about 2 more weeks in the Philly, New Jersey area. So again, we want to make sure that if you have one of those diseases that puts you at risk, you may want to talk to your physician about getting that vaccination just so that you're good to the end. So we have some interesting times. We have three authors coming in the near future. One is Deepak Chopra, and he's be coming here in January. And he is a endocrinologist who started in Jersey and basically now takes care of, knows everybody, beetles, et cetera, but a high-flying, high-output individual. He'll be with us in January. And he also has his partner, Dr. Brian Fertig, and a PhD. So my impression is these gentlemen will be here. We anticipate they'll be here in a few weeks. So what about the pattern? And they have a publication coming out of two volumes, incredible books. They're supposed to be published this year. And apparently there's already 20,000 requests for this two volume book. It's kind of high tech, but people can understand it. Brian Fertig, who is the main author, has done a great job of keeping things easy. But I did pick up one graph before these guys get here. And it was very interesting that if you take a look at it, humans who are on a regular schedule usually have their deepest sleep at around 2 in the morning. Their temperature lowers to the lowest at 4 a.m. This is, of course, somebody on a regular schedule. They have your sharpest rise in blood pressure at 6:45 a.m. if you're on a regular schedule, which is kind of interesting because usually the major heart attacks occur after that. So is it the initial blood pressure rise that causes it? Probably not. They do note that melatonin secretion, kind of your knock you out internal hormone, that stops at about 7:30 a.m. And I can't believe that these guys have noted that bowel movements are likely at 8:30 a.m. What a regimentation they've predicted. And for men, the highest testosterone level is at 9 a.m. So that's why sometimes you gals have to chase that guy out to work before 9 a.m., please. Their highest alertness is at 10 a.m. 12 noon looks good and clear. Your best coordination, can you believe this? Coordination is at 2:30 in the afternoon. The fastest reaction time is at 3:30 in the afternoon. So basically they ought to put the baseball players in the World Series in at around 3:30. At 5 p.m., that's the greatest cardiovascular efficiency and muscle strength. So make sure you cut your lawn at 5 p.m. By 6:30, your blood pressure is the highest. What a surprise. And by 7 o'clock, you have the highest body temperature. And then around 9 p.m., melatonin starts to go out to make sure you go to bed. And believe it or not, I can't even believe this fact. That's the main reason I brought this up, that at 22:30, bowel movements are suppressed. So that is a phenomenal finding of how the inner clock in humans works. And again, although blood pressure peaks in the evening, the sharpest rise in BP occurs in the morning and was originally thought to be a factor in morning increase in cardiovascular events. But these guys are checking everything out. So I've got to give a quote here. Nothing in the world is worth having or worth doing unless it means effort, pain, difficulty. I have never in my life envied a human being who led an easy life. I have envied a great many people who led difficult lives and lead them well. That's from Dr. Brian J. Fertig, MD. He'll be with us. He is one of the authors in the two-volume text, which is coming out this week. And basically is going to be a hitter. But I would say not generally for the public unless you want to really get down and absorb nitty-gritty type things. So let me just talk a little bit about pharmacology, like we were just talking about timing. So again, when you have a drug therapy, for instance, say like a nitroglycerin. So nitroglycerin basically comes in a bottle. They took out the cotton years ago because little did they know the nitroglycerin in the little bottle would jump onto the cotton. So when someone took the tablet, they didn't get any better. And remember, when you take nitroglycerin, you're supposed to take it one every 5 minutes up to three, and then it's time to hit the road to the hospital. But they had cotton in it originally going back because they didn't want these little tablets, which were melted in your mouth. to break up. And little did they know the nitroglycerin wasn't working because the nitroglycerin jumped from the tablet to the cotton. So therefore, there was a lot of failures in nitroglycerin when it kind of came out with the cotton availability. But with the nitroglycerin, if you know, you have to take it one, and then you wait 5 minutes, please sit down. If it's not, your chest pressure is not any better, you can take a second. You're waiting another 5 minutes. Then you're going to your third. If your third nitroglycerin works, relieves chest pain, relieves pressure, you're feeling a lot better, the sweats may be abated, you know, then you're okay. If it's still going after three, it's the call time to call 911 and get a ride to the hospital because you have to have that cardiovascular status checked on. So another item that has come up via the New England Journal of Medicine, this was September 21st, heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, a metabolic disease. So this is very interesting because generally you think that when your heart's ability to squeeze and kick out a certain amount of blood is highly efficient, especially when you're young, what happens when that ejection fraction falls off? So there is different, there's what they call heart failure with decreased ejection fraction and heart failure with ejection fraction. So in other words, there's got to be somebody put, i.e. God, put into your heart different ways of making sure that you last a long time. But when your ejection fraction is below 40%, so that means if you have 100 cc's and you kick out 39, you have what they call a decreased ejection fraction because you're 39% and not over the 40. So heart failure is characterized by reduced ejection fraction. The heart's not as efficient. And if you have heart failure, you get, you know, blood in your lungs, you get that shortness of breath, you have to sit down. If your ejection fraction is preserved, they call that heart failure with ejection fractions between 40 and 50% to be considered mid-range. And therefore, you would say that's heart failure without loss of ejection fraction. The pump is still kind of doing the thing. So the individuals at Novo Nordisk generated a study that was going to try and see if GLP-1, their medication, Wegovy, Ozempic, that would improve the lifestyle of somebody who had decreased ejection fraction, but still considered within normal limits because it was above that 40%. So it turns out that the GLP-1s were given, and lo and behold, there was less heart failure symptoms. And that was in patients who had preserved ejection fractions, and they did incredibly well. So glucagon-1 peptides have entered arena to combat heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. A statement, and if you look at the stock market, you can see a lot of people buy into that by putting their money into these GLP-1 companies. So again, the overall, a GLP-1 redistributes fat. So does it get rid of the fat in the wrong place that causes more cardiovascular events? It decreases inflammation. It inhibits glucagon production, which is our counter to insulin, and delays gastric emptying. GLP-1 receptors have not yet been clearly identified in human cardiac myocytes, which argues against the direct effect of the GLP-1 agonism on cardiac myocytes. But we have to give Novo kudos as they came up with proof that if you have preserved ejection fraction and heart failure, that GLP-1s help you out. We note that NT-proBNP levels are often lower in people with obesity. This study was completed with preserved ejection fraction over 40%, and it appears to be very beneficial. And again, why do people get GLP-1s? Is it because of weight? Is it because their sugars get better? Is it because they feel better, or is it better because their heart can function better with GLP-1s? Please note that it also does a great job of preventing strokes. I don't know if that's officially approved by the FDA yet, that last statement. Want to move on to another item that came out. And in the world of cardiovascular disease, we hear that we're having possible vaccinations to decrease atherosclerotic plaquing in your arteries. And I have to point out that one of the things I learned very early in my career was from a vascular surgeon who since passed away, that if you hear a bruit in someone's neck, which means that there's some plaque buildup in the carotids. We have two carotids, one going up the right and the left. That's why your doctor will put sometimes a stethoscope up to your neck to try and see how the flow is from your heart into your brain. So what happens is that there is a LPA. It's a medical term for a lipoprotein particle that they call A. And this lipoprotein particle can be measured. And probably 20% of heart patients have this problem. And if you can knock out the LPA, we would anticipate that you would live longer and better. So Eli Lilly had a publication out, muvalaplin, the first oral agent being developed to lower lipoprotein A levels, was shown to reduce levels in phase one trial with no safety concern, researchers said. So epidemiologic and genetic evidence suggests that LPA has a causal role in cardiovascular disease events. So if you've got somebody in your family who dies early, and say 40, say 50, and you can see that three brothers get it, it's time to get your LPA level drawn. Make sure you draw it before 8 in the morning. Make sure you get it in a fasting state. So in this study, muvalaplin, owned by Eli Lilly, reduced by approximately 80% with an antisense oligonucleotide. Aren't you happy you're here to hear that word? And it's called pelacarsen, P-E-L-A-C-A-R-S-E-N. My impression is it's not on the market yet. Apparently, the major developer is Ionis, I-O-N-I-S, that by up to 98% of RNA interference was generated. So this is a small molecule that disrupts the binding of apolipoprotein A to ApoB1 that forms LPA. So what they have is they have this A molecule jumping on an LDL particle, and that causes a significant advance in cardiovascular disease. If you have a high LPA, you definitely want to get it treated, and it's going to generate significant benefit, as you can see what this paper is going to show us. Approximately 20% of the population have high lipoprotein small A levels, the author, Dr. Nichols, noted. We saw in the PCSK9 inhibitor trials that LPA lowering is associated with benefit, but those agents substantially lower LDL cholesterol. So in other words, are certain medications that we're using now, they basically don't get LPA. LPA just keeps on floating. Now here, for the first time ever, we have an oral agent that lowers LPA. We will still need to determine if this leads to a reduction in cardiovascular risk. Early heart disease in your family, more than one of your brothers and sisters getting a heart attack, more than one of your brother's sisters on Christmas Eve have to go and get a quadruple bypass and then be told that they have to come back for their carotids at a few weeks later. That's an LPA bandito. So please, that in this study, 55 participants in the study were randomly assigned to receive muvalaplin at various doses from 1 milligram to 800 milligrams. And they had an age of 29 years of age. Notice they get the guys who are younger. 64% female. Yes, girls get this too. And it doesn't matter whether you're a male or a female, LPA will take you out. The mean LPA level was 10.3, but there's various levels on that. But what's the bottom line? There were no deaths or serious events. Treatment-associated adverse events were reported by 62%. Mild and transient included headache, fatigue, and vomiting. Nothing like keeping you alive. Significant effects on LDL cholesterol, HDL cholesterol, total cholesterol, not at all. This drug just works on LPA. So yes, you would need your statin drug or your GLP-1 drug and take this along. But basically, good news for those with LPA elevations, good news for those people who aren't diagnosed and have multiple family members going the cardiovascular way early in life. But this drug looks fantastic. Make sure you get yourself diagnosed with an LPA. So we just want to go to a little bit of a lighter topic. So toothbrushing linked to better glucose levels in type 2 diabetics. I am sure every mother is going to tell their kids about this. Toothbrushing linked to better glucose levels in type 2 diabetes. Toothbrushing two times per day may improve glycemic control for people with type 2 diabetes. There are several papers that have had enough evidence to show there was small improvement in A1C if you started brushing your teeth twice a day, but it wasn't rigorous research. Adults with self-reported brushing their teeth more often also had better glycemic control as measured by better hemoglobin A1C levels, two-hour postprandial sugars. Oh, do people hate to get that two-hour postprandial to see how high their sugar goes. But it certainly does decrease the carbohydrates that they want to take. So push that bread off that cheesesteak and just get the good stuff inside. So anyway, so the answer is that two-hour postprandial plasma glucose and fasting sugars improved. Research is clearly needed. Hopefully that research will generate enough evidence that toothbrushing as a self-care behavior will be considered for inclusion in the standards of care for the American Diabetes Association. The author, we really have to emphasize the importance of brushing your teeth at least twice a day. All the kids of the world, make sure your mother doesn't hear about this. Okay, so we just want to talk, we talked a little bit earlier about menopause. That kind of comes up, especially with this newer agent on the market. And that 31.3% reported having a dedicated menopause curriculum for trainees. My impression is with this new drug coming out and the old drugs of estrogen supplementation, if someone doesn't have that risk of an estrogen complication, make basically menopausal symptom state a big item that should be modified and treated better. Many residents do not have access to menopausal clinic, menopausal expert, or designated menopausal curriculum at their institution. Hopefully that will change. We only have right now in the OB-GYN programs across the U.S., 31% have a menopausal curriculum training. We hope that that will improve. So let's just define menopause. The transition to menopause, formally defined as the absence of menstrual cycles for 12 months, is a universal experience for reproductively competent women who live long enough. I do want to point out that I think that's a joke myself. You have to have hot flashes for 12 months before someone will give you an estrogen or maybe this new medication. We'd note that postmenopausal state can have significant swings in moods, and that can be a significant issue. These hot flashes, depressive and anxiety symptoms, sleep disorders, memory complaints, GU symptoms, vaginal dryness, discomfort with intercourse, and signs such as bone loss and metabolic disorders are very tough to take if you are a postmenopausal woman. Every day I thank God that I'm a guy. So when considered as a portal to the second half of life, menopause provides an opportunity for women to reassess habits, lifestyle, and ongoing medical concerns and turn a corner to enhance their quality of life and health for the remaining lifespan, usually 30 plus years. So we definitely want to jump on the band on this. An estimated 6,000 US women pass this landmark daily. That's a lot of gals. And 2 million annually. So one would anticipate that medical education regarding menopausal options for symptom relief and long-term preventive health strategies would be paramount in the minds of those who develop curriculum for medical school and postgraduate training. The cover of a recent New York Times Magazine article by Susan Dominus included the simple leading statement, quote, "We have been misled about menopause. There are many options for symptom relief, including the menopause hormone therapy. Despite the confusion regarding the results of Women's Health Initiative clinical trial, which basically knocked out a significant amount of estrogen use by prescribers, and basically the benefits of getting those hot flashes reduced certainly hasn't been realized, and hopefully with the new medication and new outlook, that will occur. It's time for the program directors of all primary care specialties to review priorities and address menopause, a a universal experience with health considerations for 50% of the populations. My impression is the girls will rise up and take care of that. So there is a statement about we're kind of on the girls' side here. Trial of vitamin D supplementation raises questions about cardiovascular events on older adults. So in a trial of more than 20,000 adults older than 60 years of age, vitamin D supplementation tended toward reducing risk for major cardiovascular events compared with placebo. In the main results from the D-Health trial published in The Lancet, there was no difference between vitamin D and placebo groups in all-cause mortality, cardiovascular mortality, cancer mortality, or other causes of mortality. I can say as an endocrinologist, my main deal to try and get people vitamin D supplement is because we want better bones, and that if someone is vitamin D deficient, they are at a significant risk for losing bone mass. When you lose bone mass, you lose bone strength. But in my practice, we basically titrate people's serum calcium in the fasting state to 9.6. That's the mean in the population. Are you taking 2,000 IU a D to get there? Are you taking 5,000 a day? Some people even need more. There is a risk of getting too much calcium, too much vitamin D, because the calcium that you don't need in your bones will flow into the urine, which predisposes the kidney stones. So if you're somebody who has stones, you have to really be monitored. There's a little tricks of the trade where if someone has bad bones and stones, we can give indapamide, the friendly diuretic that's been on the market for 20 years. And when they take that, it's a water pill, it's not like a Lasix that you have to go like a fire hose. But what it does is it sends back the calcium back into the bones. So indapamide, been on the market 30 plus years. If you have stones, you can take a look at your serum calcium at 9.6. That's in the middle of the road. You can take your vitamin D to titrate up that. If you have kidney stones or you're told by your physician that you have high urinary calcium, you can take indapamide one a day. So that basically prevents stones and gives you better bones. So overall, if you're taking a look at women's health, there's a very high concurrent use of statins and other cardiovascular drugs. That's good because the girls were told they were going to live forever, which wasn't true. So they can get their statins, they can get their vitamin D. Remember, there's D2 and D3. D2 is the older stuff. That's when we couldn't manufacture D3 economically. So D2 is older. It doesn't absorb as well as D3. You're usually looking for 2,000 IU of vitamin D, D3. You can certainly go up to 5,000 if your serum calcium is less than 9.6. Remember, there's always those people who are what we call renal calcium leakers. There are people who will form a stone. And their urologist or endocrinologist or family doctor could add in some of the medication I just talked about, indapamide, which will help them keep the calcium in their bones and not in their kidneys. So overall summation, these findings indicate that vitamin D supplementation might reduce the incidence of major cardiovascular events. That's a new study, particularly myocardial infarction and coronary revascularization. So this is above and beyond the bone effect. This protective effect could be more marked in those taking statins or other cardiovascular drugs at baseline. Conclusion that vitamin D supplement does not alter risk of cardiovascular disease are premature. So everything is not 100%, but I would certainly recommend that people stick to a vitamin D supplement if their serum calcium in the fasting state is less than 9.6. So we're going to move on to a different topic. So one of the things that I liked about being a doctor is that we got exposed to many different clinics. And in each clinic, there's a more or less a higher concentration of a certain disease state. So because I did a lot of ICU work, I was exposed a lot to people who came in for heart transplantation. So that is real business. And I have to say that it was challenging. And basically, I never really liked it because you're basically extracting tissue from a human who's passed away and who is good enough to volunteer some of their body parts so that others can benefit. So, you know, there's all sorts of dirty transplantation around the world. And more countries are known to have more dirty transplantation stuff. I had a patient once tell me, told the attending that I'm getting my heart from South America, and didn't know what that meant, but that's where the heart came from. So again, there was a study in the New England Journal of Medicine, November 30th of 2023. So background, hemodynamic instability and myocardial dysfunction are major factors preventing the transplantation of hearts from organ donors after brain death. Intravenous levothyroxine is widely used in donor care on the basis of observational data suggesting that more organs may be transplanted from donors who receive hormonal supplementation. So when I was the ICU doctor and a patient came in after death, was being stabilized vitals, waiting for the transplantation team to come in, because basically, at least in the Philadelphia marketplace, you're looking at Penn, Jefferson, Jersey, Our Lady of Lourdes Hospital, used to be Hahnemann, but that's gone, that these patients would come in and we'd have them on life support. And one of the things that the life support team, because they're specialized teams, they would insist that we start a drip of T3. So T3 is triiodothyronine, because the statement was that that a lot of times these patients, when they pass away and the system is closing down the lights and the energy, they said that there was a need for liothyronine. Now, liothyronine is about $300, I think it's for a day, and this is going back 20 years. And the hospital pharmacists don't like to give out liothyronine because levothyronine, the one that we run on generally and float in our bloodstream, it's our reserve, that T4 product apparently was falling in the estimation of a lot of experts when people get a transplant and pass away. So what they did is they would start T3 up, which is 400 times more potent than T4, to make sure that those hearts in the person who is now deemed brain dead on life support, they would give the T3 product. And this is 20 years ago, and the pharmacist would tell me, I said, how come I can't get it for my patients who are severe hypothyroidism and are basically near a crisis that they need thyroid hormone? And he said, it's $300, Fallon. So that's about 20 years ago. So in this particular study, in the New England Journal of Medicine, they used T4. And their comment was shortly that T4 and T3 is the same thing. So you have to remember that in the business of thyroid hormone, T4 is your basically your reservoir. But that means there's four iodines hooked onto this molecule. And what happens is when you get sick or when you need more thyroid hormones, such as that you're deposited, you know, on the corner waiting for the taxi and the temperature is 20 degrees, what your body does is break the T4 molecule off. There's four iodines to one spot off, and that increases the potency of the thyroid hormone by 400%. So again, you know, God built a way that he can respond quickly. So say you're driving up 295, the temperature is 20 degrees out, your heater's on in the car, and you decide that you're going to stick your arm out the window, and you decided to go 70 miles an hour because the police officer is, you know, trailing you. So how come your arm doesn't fall off? I've used this analogy many times, because what happens is the thyroid hormone, which has got four iodine molecules hooked on it, breaks one off in the right place, and that increases the potency 400-fold. So all of a sudden, within seconds, if you stick your arm out and you've got your right hand holding the steering wheel, don't let go, the thyroid hormone heats up and saves those fingers from falling off, even though you got your gloves on, because you're going 100 miles an hour to beat the cop. It's cold as heck out there, and you've got the heater on inside, but the heater inside is not helping your left arm. So it increases the potency 400-fold and basically keeps your hand from falling off. So the same thing happens. If you start reading a book, the iodine gets broken off in your brain so that you can increase the potency of that thyroid hormone for efficacy so you can get that book down and remember everything in the book. So the issue here is in this particular study, my biggest complaint is that I didn't see where they proved that using the levothyroxine is equivalent to the triiodothyronine, but the study regretfully didn't pan out. In hemodynamically unstable brain-dead potential heart donors, intravenous levothyroxine infusion did not result in significantly more hearts being transplanted than saline infusion. So again, they basically said the deterioration, they're very picayune about when they decide to transplant somebody. We have the season coming up, because I had two of my patients last Christmas time get liver transplants or kidney transplants, kind of like within 2 weeks of Christmas. So make sure you don't want to be a donor. If you don't want to be a donor, make sure you behave yourself this year. But anyway, so my complaint about the article in New England Journal of Medicine, little am I to say that the article's not right, but they said that there was no benefit giving IV T4, which is much less expensive than giving the T3. So an observer influence, my impression, they made an assumption, and I would have complained a little bit on how things go. So I'm going to move on a little bit here. Got to come up with something else. Want to talk a little bit about aspirin. So aspirin is a great drug. There's all sorts of issues. Generally, somebody who has an hematocrit over 54 should be on a baby aspirin a day. That's Joe Fallon and I think basically many of the other practicing clinicians. So again, when you get ketchupy blood, and that's what I mean by the hematocrit. So that means that over what percentage of your blood is going to be blood versus serum. So again, when you get a 54%, that usually means you're having some sort of problem. Do you have undiagnosed sleep apnea? Is there some issue with your with how you're making up your blood? So again, the issue here is that if you have an hematocrit over 54, you kind of have what I call ketchupy blood. And I do recommend my patients, if there's not a contraindication, to use an 81 enteric-coated aspirin. So the enteric coat, I think, is kind of important, because the biggest complaint about aspirin therapy is GI bleeding. And for someone to use an enteric coated aspirin decreases the chance significantly of GI bleeds. Now, you got to remember that they originally made aspirin in bathtubs because it was so corrosive. It would tend to eat through things. But I will tell you this, that there's a number of patients that I usually see that have high hematocrits. Either they've got heart failure, or a lot of them basically have sleep apnea and are undiagnosed. Because basically what's happening is they're losing their oxygen content to where the body and brain wants it at night. So what happens is they just now pack up, making more red blood cells, so that when the middle of the night comes, when they stop breathing, that they have the oxygen to come off that extra amount of blood that's hanging in their blood. The only problem is when your blood gets higher, your viscosity goes up, which predisposes to other items such as stroke. So again, if you have somebody who's got an hematocrit, that's on your lab test. There's the hemoglobin, which gives you the amount of hemoglobin, and then the other one is the hematocrit, which is showing you what percentage of red cells are taking up your blood. If it's a 54, 98% of the hematologists will recommend you lose a unit of blood at their place. And if you're a 52, you're going to get about 50% are going to recommend that you lose a pint of blood so that you don't have that ketchupy blood. So again, if you've got ketchupy blood, you have to think about it. How come you went to see an endocrinologist? Is it because of decreased libido? Is it because your testosterone level is low? It's one of the reasons. So again, do you need a sleep test? Do you have to have your partner say, yes, you snore like mad, and that's why sometimes I get out of the bed at night? So again, if you have a hematocrit of 54, talk to a hematologist. If you're 52, start to think about talking to the hematologist, but make sure you go. So just want to make sure that everybody knows that the hematocrit is very important in viscosity of blood, and we want to make sure that everybody sticks around a long time. So the other item to talk about is going to be diabetes. So again, diabetes is kind of like what I spend most of my time with. Remember that there's something called an hematocrit. And remember that things are brand new out there. These new medication, these new devices that can monitor your blood sugar are absolutely phenomenal. A lot of people use a pump. These pumps can be phenomenal. A lot of people use sensors. one of the problems with the sensors is now that if you use a sensor, the insurance companies don't want to let you use a finger pricker to confirm. I do have to point out that generally the FDA's rule is that the sensor is superior to the finger stick. Remember that the finger stick is always 15 minutes behind. So people sometimes go crazy on me. How can this machine be any good? And the only way to try and calm them down is to tell them to go to the lab, stick their finger right on the spot, do their assessment, and then have the lab do the data. The point of the matter is, though, is remember, the finger sticker or cricker is basically 15 minutes behind. So if you're a doctor, you have a little bit of an out and say it doesn't have to match 100%. But generally, these machines have done a great job of revolutionizing it. I mean, there's people who, when they lose their pump and lose their sensor that's on board, they just kind of say, I almost fall apart, Dr. Fallon. Because the answer is that you want to know what your sugar is so you can make the right moves. What's nice about these sensors is that you can also see the change in function over time, because you can predict when you're going to go low. So I think it's very, very important that sensors are in. There's three different companies that do it. If you're on Medicare, you have to be on insulin. And if you're on Medicare, usually they'll help you out. Now, one item that's important is that how to treat low blood sugar. I kind of hark on this all the time. Eating candy ain't the best. It's important that the ambulance guys, they use what they call a glucose gel. It's a double dose. And I think if you're a diabetic and have any risk or any medication that can cause you to go have a low sugar under 60, that you should have some of these glucose pens or little containers that you can just break off the top and squeeze it in your mouth. I tell everybody, if you have a police officer that's coming behind you while you're driving, and the officer, which you didn't know about it, was following you because you were doing a little swivel on the line, very important, before the officer walks up, to please take that glucose gel, break off the tip, and squirt it in your mouth. Remember, he does not know if you're on drugs. He doesn't know if you're lit. He wants to make sure that he's safe and that you're safe by pulling you over. So please squirt that in your mouth before he comes, so that way when he has you stand up and stand on your toes and all that kind of stuff, that you've already started to respond by raising your sugar over 60. So glucose gel is very important. Some people are still using orange juice. I want to point out that orange juice takes 23 minutes in general to raise your sugar above 60. So who wants to sit around for 26 minutes till your sugar gets over 60? The glucose gels work much faster. Coca-Cola takes only 13 minutes. Please make sure you drink your Coke quick, get that down so that by the time the officer walks up, it's safer for you, it's safer for him, and you're out of your hypoglycemic if you had that. So if you got the weave and the officer pulls you over, please make sure that's within distance. You can reach it and squirt it in your mouth, and hopefully the event will result in you moving forward instead of being told that you're going somewhere else to jail. Okay, so no orange juice. Coca-Cola works pretty darn good. That's about 13 minutes. Forget OJ. Okay. So one of the things I do want to talk about, going back to women's health, is DEXA scanning. So osteoporosis is a big deal in the U.S. We have all these gals living longer, which is fantastic. But one of the things is, once your estrogen has dropped to a certain level, your bone starts to disappear. It kind of like evaporates. How's that for a phrase? It's not accurate, but tells the story. So again, when you become menopausal, you're going to see an exodus of bone from your bones. Some of us have more of a risk than others. It's basically genetics. But we would recommend that if you get to be menopausal, that you get a DEXA scan baseline, see where you are. And then in 2 years and a day, you can go back in and get another DEXA scan, and you can see what's the rate of loss in your bone. So again, how to save yourself from significant problems such as fractures of the spine, fractures of the hip. Those things take a lot out of you. So again, make sure if you're menopausal, you can try those hormones, you can try your estrogen, but get a DEXA scan. Medicare pays for that. Repeat it in 2 years. The first one doesn't always count. The second one does, because you're going to see you're under a new metabolic rate of bone loss. Make sure you don't lose those heights. Remember, if you're 2.5 inches down in 2 years, you don't even need a DEXA scan. You need medication. So this is Dr. Joe Fallon going to sign off. We'll be back next week. We have some excellent guests coming. I mean, excellent. So want to take a look at our podcast, www.wwdbam.com. Hit Inside Medicine, then hit podcast, and you're going to see 125 up. Check them out. Lot to learn. Time to get smarter for the new year coming around the corner. Dr. Joe Fallon signing off. Thank you for listening to Inside Medicine.